had reached this stage of my mental evolution when in May 1870, the emperor proposed a renewal of the compact between himself and the people. No open-minded witness can contend that the subsequent deliberations were not absolutely free, nor deny that the enemies of the empire had recourse to the most unworthy weapons. While the defense of their opponents was unparalleled in its moderation, I was present at the plebiscite and took part in it. The result made it evident that the treaty between sovereign and people, if proposed by the former, had been solemnly ratified by the latter. It was idle to hark back upon December 2nd and to maintain that its events vitiated the vote of some 19 years later. Yet this was but a part, no inconsiderable part assuredly, but still only a proportion of the satisfactions demanded by the theoretic mind for one who was haunted by the desire to ameliorate the condition of the poorest and most populous class of the community. There was another set of ideas which a government was bound to apply before it could be admitted as a desirable government, suitable both to present and future requirements. Left without a leader, a nation perishes. With a leader, even when that leader has not been freely chosen, even when he has seized rather than accepted supremacy, a nation lives. But when the chief is chosen by the voice of the whole people, how great is his power for good? How vast the field opened out to him for the accomplishment of his work. The plebiscite is the only instrument by which it is possible to restrict and direct the powers of that third estate, which has hitherto furnished orators and wire pullers to every party, even to the most avowedly democratic, from the ranks of which all governments have recruited their administrators, and in which, consequently, all powers vested, even in the days of universal suffrage. This has been the case for a century. The only interludes in this dictatorship of the third estate being the periods of imperial sway. The constituent assembly proclaimed the apotheosis of the middle classes and suppressed the three powers that held them in check, the king, the nobility, and the clergy. The bourgeoisie became supreme in the legislature and the convention. The directory existed by and for it. Important as were its functions under the Restoration, the latter was not sufficiently submissive for its taste, and it accordingly substituted the monarchy of July, under which its supremacy was assured. In the Constituent Assembly of 48, as in the legislature, it attacked the anointed of the people, firstly because of the popular origin of his power, secondly because it dreaded to find in him an adversary such as it had encountered half a century before. The coup d'etat of December the 2nd was an attack not upon the sovereignty of the people, for its author was the chosen leader of the people, but upon sovereignty of the middle classes in the persons of their parliamentary representatives, whose resentment was the keener that they foresaw further encroachment on their usurpations and feared that the popular dictator would take the utmost advantage of the national vote, which had invested him with supreme powers. Simultaneously with this assumption of political authority by the middle classes, from 1830 onwards, an economic transformation had been taking place. The toil of the individual workman and the output of small workshops directed by petty traders who worked side by side with their employees had been gradually superseded by vast collective enterprises, by huge factories depending on anonymous and external funds. Under the control of impersonal and irresponsible managers, these funds were furnished by the Third Estate, for whose thought was the highest return possible for their capital, to secure which they placed the laws to government and the army at the disposal of their agents. They invented protection to increase the value of their goods and inaugurated a long series of petty tyrannies by which they forced the proletarian manufacturers to remain wretched and poverty-stricken and prevented the coalition by which he might have improved his status. They thus created antinomy as between capital and labor and justified the reprisals of that class, which we are beginning to call the Fourth Estate. Two dates will be sufficient to mark the genesis and growth of this new power. June 1832, when a popular outbreak lasted barely 2 days, and June 1848, memorable foreign insurrection which took an army to quell it and cost the lives of more generals than a great battle. It was easy to foresee the commune from the first days of 1870. One course only could have prevented this revolution, which was merely postponed by the victory of the Third Estate in 1871, from becoming in due time, not only in France, but throughout the world, the most bloody and terrible ever dreamt of, a catastrophe which will replunge humanity into barbarism. This course was the establishment of a moderate dictatorship, with a dictator sufficiently alive to the interests of the Third and the needs of the Fourth Estate to act as mediator between the two, to enforce the sacrifices necessary on both sides, and to bring about a sort of concordat between the conflicting classes. But the authority of a dictator who should successfully bring about such an evolution in the industrial order, as was accomplished by Napoleon I in the agrarian order, could only be sustained by national suffrage. And this, by virtue of its democratic character, would restore the balance of power as between the moneyed minority and the indigent majority, and ensure the election of a chief by that majority. If a sovereign, basing his claim on divine right, be radically disqualified for such leadership by his origin, his surroundings, his supporters, the very principle of his power, how much more is this the case of an assembly made up of the very persons it is proposed to dispossess? The nobility indeed may cite that the 4th of August, when it renounced its hereditary privileges, the sacrifice was immense, but it was a sacrifice of pride only, and not a purse. The nobles did not renounce their pecuniary privileges, but agreed to their redemption by the nation. There will be no 4th of August in the history of the Third Estate. Its privileges are based on money, and money it will never be induced to relinquish. Personally, Napoleon III perceived the greatness of his mission, personally not as a man of strong will, for he had little force of character, nor as a man of genius, for he had no genius, but as a man of intelligence, honesty, and deep convictions. He had prepared himself to play his part. Unhappily, throughout his reign, he was the hostage of the Third Estate, in spite of which, and as the opponent of which, he had been elected, forced by the Constitution from the very beginning to choose his ministers from a middle-class assembly avowedly hostile to him. He was obliged to govern through an executive, not one member of which had voted for him. In later times, when he had shaken off the yoke of the assembly, he was driven by force of circumstances to choose all his instruments of government from among the Third Estate. Whether they came from the right or the left, they were all alike. And it was only by dint of that gentle obstinacy peculiar to him that the emperor succeeded in forcing upon them those principles of social reform he himself had at heart. Had he not found supporters among a certain class of men whose middle-class extraction had been neutralized by a phase of adhesion to the Saint-Simonian sect, and who still professed the cult of humanity, the dreams of the exiled author of The Extinction of Pauperism would have remained but dreams. It is possible that a greater part might have been played by some other leader, but none other, fettered as he was, could have shown a more entire comprehension of and devotion to the cause of the people. At the time, however, I saw nothing but the result. It was already great, but realities will always fall short of a youthful ideal with its impatience of gradual development. It was no inconsiderable victory over my acquired prejudices to admit that the imperial power rested on a legitimate basis. The further concession that the man who wielded this power had to a great extent understood and fulfilled his mission was the logical result of wider experience. And honesty itself compelled it, but to establish in my mind the sovereign conviction that absorbs all other sentiments, that produces a fanaticism born of faith, some electric spark falling upon the scattered elements, infusing them into sudden illumination, was still necessary. This, too, was forthcoming. I lived through September the 4th and all its horrors, the disgrace of that shameful revolt in the enemy's presence, of cries for peace raised among the soldiers laying down their arms, rage against the invader, disgust at
imbecile bravado, hatred of the Orleanist liars who flung open the gate of that palace in which they had sworn fidelity to the emperor, to a horde of ruffians and prostitutes. I suffered the tortures of all those. In the brilliant autumn sunshine, I saw and heard a reeling, dancing mob pour into the Rue de la Paix, insulting the column as they passed, plunge into the Rue de Rivoli, and blackened as with a darkly swelling tide the Place de la Concorde. I saw and heard and would have gladly laid down my life to save France from the shame of these things on the morrow of Sedan, and the justification of this betrayal of their country by certain Parisians was offered in the very phrase which our good friends of the Allies were fond of using in 1814. Prussia is not at war with France, but with the Emperor. Then I felt and understood that, consciously or not, those who argued thus were the accomplices of the invaders, that the overthrow of the empire meant the surrender of France. That now and then, the Napoleon and the nation were inseparable, not only as for us, but as against monarchical Europe. And that day alone had made the nation formidable.